It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, as climate talks continue in Paris, we talk to a critic of the Obama administration's clean power plan.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
New census data released this week shows that household incomes in many of Wisconsin's counties declined in the last 5 years.
And Governor Walker held an economic development conference in northern Wisconsin this week, where he announced the region would receive grants to expand broadband internet access.
Joining us now to talk about those stories and more is Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, first let's talk about the U.S. Census data that came out yesterday shows household income in Wisconsin is down in, what is it, two-thirds of the counties. Tell us about that report.
Yeah, so this is new data that was just released looking at house median incomes in Wisconsin between 2009 and 2014, and the story is grim. Indeed, two-thirds of the counties are seeing declines. At about 25% saw no change, and only two counties saw actual increases in median incomes. So that is not a good economic story. In a lot of cases, there were double digit declines. Almost everywhere lost ground. Milwaukee County had lost 10.3%. The median income there is $43,385. But others, I mean, Kenosha County, Manitowoc County, Juneau County, Jackson County, all lost more than 10%. Vilas County lost 13.3%. So what the census data say is that it does mirror a national trend, but it really puts some meat on the claim that the Great Recession really is having an enduring effect.
So this is a national trend. This isn't a cheese stands alone kind of story. Is Wisconsin typically in line with how the rest of the country, the same kind of numbers there in the decline?
So yes and no, right? It is a national trend, and what it shows is a story that this data shows from 2009 to 2014. So that captures sort of the worst of the Great Recession and the sort of long, slow recovery. And I think it was just this year that that Wisconsin and many other places also reached the number of jobs that were lost, regained that number of jobs. But what it shows is the jobs that have come back. This is true in Wisconsin, and it is true nationally, have been lower paying. They're worse jobs. A small part of this, it would be interesting to break down. We need more detailed data. A small part of it has to do with an aging workforce, that some people, their median, their household income is going to go down as they retire. But I think that the way that analysts see it is that largely this is long-term effects of the recession, and that's a sad story.
And it sounds like analysts also saying, can you file this under the decline of the middle class, that heading?
For sure. I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about, right? Median income, sort of by definition, this is middle class. It is worth noting, this hit rural counties and urban counties. It hit Wisconsin's richest counties. Waukesha County is the richest, has the highest median income in the state of about $76,000. And they saw their incomes decline by 7.1%, just like most of the state. So it definitely speaks to the way that the middle class has been affected in the last 5 years. But it is worth saying it's not what the data don't show is some parts of Wisconsin sort of excelling and leaving behind the rest of the state. It's kind of bad everywhere.
Now, a bit of a silver lining on this, and not much of one, but rents. Wisconsin not spending as much on rent as other parts of the country.
That's right, and that is important to sort of middle class prosperity broadly. It is true that was on the whole lower than the national average, less than a third. There is a point at which rent spending becomes so oppressive and burdensome to the middle class that it becomes a real obstacle. That's not Wisconsin's major problem right now. So you can consider that a silver lining. It's sort of, I think that might seem like weak tea to some.
We're talking to Robert Menser right now, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald, talking about the latest stories from Wisconsin for our Wisconsin News Roundup. And we're switching gears here. Now, the state has announced a number of grants to expand access to broadband internet in rural areas. What do we know about the grants?
Yeah, Governor Walker was in Trigo, Wisconsin on Tuesday in the northwest of the state for the Northern Wisconsin Economic Development Summit. And as one part of this summit, and then also in subsequent days as sort of a swing through some Northwood cities, the governor has announced a number of grants for rural broadband expansion. This follows from $1.5 million that were in the budget, put into the budget to expand these rural broadband programs. So there are some specifics that came out this week, a $70,000 grant in Langlade County, a $100,000 grant to a company in the Northwest called Northwest Communications that's going to do a lot of expansion in the Northwoods, looking at about $500,000 in new grants overall. And the idea, it's this, you know, this is sort of a longstanding and incremental process to grow broadband in the Northwoods, but it's a there's sort of two parts of it. The first is that expanding broadband, the argument goes, can boost economic activity and can allow people who are in rural areas to start a business, reach people beyond their sort of the borders of their community. And the other big argument is that it bolsters the tourism industry. You know, people might say they want to get away from their email and their Facebook, but by their actual behavior, they really don't. They would rather have access to those things on their Northwoods vacations.
And you've been covering this for a while. How has the limited availability of broadband affected residents and businesses in that area?
We hear this from rural areas. That this is for one thing. I mean, just fundamentally, it's a frustration for residents. There's an argument that it's a solid argument that this has a real economic impact and that having access to broadband boosts the economy. But also, I mean, what I hear most often as a journalist probably is from residents who just feel like they're missing out, you know? So this has been an ongoing issue for sure, and it's sort of a rare bit of bipartisan agreement. We had, just this week, the Assembly Democrats unveiled a slate of economic development bills, that are meant to sort of show what Democrats would do if they were in charge of state government, and, they had, you know, some sort of more traditionally controversial policies like raising the minimum wage, but right alongside there is expansion of broadband access in rural areas. So it is something that, like I said, it's been progress has been incremental, but at this point, everybody seems to agree that this is an important step into the future for the Northwoods.
So to wrap up, we learned earlier this week that around 15,000 Wisconsin residents were dropped from the state's food stamp program this week. What's the story there?
Yeah, so this is the fruit of a 2013 policy that put new work requirements on it applies to able-bodied adults, which translates to adults between the ages of 18 and 50 who are not disabled, who do not have children at home or have other exemptions. There are exemptions for pregnant women, and there are other other exemptions, but when you get down to it, they're looking at about 60,000 recipients that fell under these new requirements, which took effect in this year. They, after 3 months, this was the rule. After 3 months, if they are not working 80 hours a week or sort of showing that they are seeking work and, you know, showing the state in some specific ways, that they would lose access. And so we saw of these 60,000 or so recipients, this month, Wisconsin State Journal looked at the data and found that about 15,000 had in fact been kicked out of the program.
Now, people who work with food banks have been speaking up about this. What are they worried about?
Yeah, so this is the, you know, there are Republicans who argue that this is exactly how the program is supposed to be working, and that you know, able-bodied adults who aren't seeking work shouldn't be receiving government benefits. The argument from those who are advocates for those in poverty or food banks is that it's essentially the government is offloading this this responsibility onto private food banks, churches, and charities, and that what we're going to see in this season of high demand at food banks anyway is that some of these places might be swamped, and it's going to put additional pressure on them.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was news editor Robert Menser helping us recap the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Week one of the Paris Climate Conference is coming to a close. While President Obama has returned to Washington, his administration will continue working through next week to try to reach a global agreement on cutting carbon emissions.
The largest component of President Obama's climate action plan, what he's offering to foreign leaders to show his commitment, is the Clean Power Plan. The EPA released the plan earlier this year, setting targets for each state in the country to reduce carbon emissions by the year 2030.
Here in Wisconsin, the goal is to reduce emissions to 34% below their 2012 levels. In response, two dozen states, including Wisconsin, have filed suit in a pending case to block the regulations. Here with us to make the argument as to why the Clean Power Plan should be dropped is Brett Healy, president of the MacGyver Institute. Brett, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what's the crux of your case against the Clean Power Plan and these targets for Wisconsin and all the other states?
Well, I think what you're seeing here is an underhanded attempt by the president and faceless bureaucrats to fundamentally change the American way of life. And remember that back in 2010, the president tried to pass cap and trade through Congress when his party had large majorities in each house, and he was unable to convince members of his own party to do this. So what we're seeing now, unfortunately, is an underhanded attempt through the rules process to impose this on the American people.
And how would you see this affecting Wisconsin in particular, where we rely on coal a lot more than many other states for our energy or for our electricity?
Well, the impact here in Wisconsin will be quite dramatic. As you pointed out, Wisconsin is a coal-dependent state, so these regulations would hit us harder than most other states. The analysis that we ran under the draft rule, so this isn't our numbers only reflect the original draft goal of 30% reduction, not the 32% reduction in the final rule, but that analysis alone showed by 2030, residential electric rates would be $225 higher than they are now. The average business would pay over $1,500 more for their electric bill. And here's the staggering one. Manufacturing businesses, which are obviously very, very dependent on electricity to produce their product, their electric bills would be up over $100,000 a year by 2030 if this rule goes through. We also, our analysis using a modeling analysis showed that we would lose over 21,000 jobs in Wisconsin because of the higher cost to businesses, and almost $2 billion in disposable income would be taken out of the economy as people are required to pay more and more for their electric bills.
One of the ideas of this legislation, is that the coal electricity will be replaced by natural gas and renewables in particular, and that this will be a stimulus that'll help renewable energy production get more efficient, work on a wider scale, become more cost effective. Does your projection take that into effect?
No, our projection looks at strictly replacing coal plants here in Wisconsin with other forms. And what you're talking about would be good if it was market driven. The problem here is that with the government imposing these regulations, unelected bureaucrats imposing these regulations on our economy, it's going to have a dramatic impact on Wisconsinites. And this economy, I'm not sure of any Wisconsinites who would want to pay $200 to $250 more for their electric bill.
There are growing warnings from the scientific community around the world about the impact of climate change led by CO2 emissions, many of them from coal-powered electric plants. Do we need to weigh those costs, the risks that go along with those costs, against the costs you're talking about to the modern-day economy?
And I think that should be part of the debate. And I think that's what we should be doing at this point, is having a debate led by the president, who feels so strongly about this issue, about whether or not this is the right direction for our country. And then if he believes the American people support him in this effort, then he should introduce another bill and try and pass it through Congress. But the big problem here is the backhanded attempt to use the rules process and then to have this fight in the courts on whether or not his administration is overstepping its bounds. And the problem is that once we go down this road, the judicial system does not work in a very timely fashion, and a lot of these utilities will need to make decisions about capital outlays now if they think this rule is going to stick. And even if down the road the judicial system steps in and says, President Obama, you overstepped your bounds, this rule is null and void, a lot of the decisions will have already been made at the local level to implement this costly plan. And once you start heading down that road, there's going to be no way for utilities to change course, and consumers are going to be stuck with the higher electricity rates.
Talking to Brett Healy, president of the MacIver Institute, about the EPA Clean Power Plan requiring setting targets for states to reduce carbon emissions from power plants, from electrical plants. Brett, you're talking about the impact on the economy. People look at coal as a cheap source of electricity. A Harvard Medical School study back in 2011 looked at externalities, other costs of coal, putting an annual cost to the United States between $330 and $500 billion. Things like the impact of pollution, impacts on health, that sort of thing. Is coal really as cheap as we think it is?
Well, I think for the consumer, it certainly is the least expensive and most reliable form of electricity. Keep in mind, too, right, that renewables are not all that reliable at this point. I don't have any doubt in the future that through innovation and the market, we will figure out a solution on how to store wind and solar power. But right now, we just don't have that capability. And also, Wisconsin, on its own, a few years back, decided that it would pursue clean coal technology. And it was through those efforts and over $11 billion spent by the industry and they spent that money to reduce carbon dioxide output here in Wisconsin. And between 2005 and 2012, we reduced carbon dioxide by 15%. So this idea that we need the federal government to impose a top-down, one-size-fits-all rule on every state to push us this in this direction is wrong. Wisconsin actually is an example of what can be done at the local level to make progress in this area.
We're hearing arguments in Paris now that the clock is ticking. We need to do more. We need to take more drastic action. And quickly, you point out that the court process is fairly slow. Also, the congressional process is pretty slow, too. Does that justify some sort of more drastic action like this clean power plan from the White House?
Well, and the biggest problem with that idea, I would argue, is that if you look at the EPA's own modeling, they estimate that once fully implemented, the Clean Power Plan would lower temperature in the United States by 0.02 Celsius. So even if we fully implement all of these new regulations and dramatically change our way of life by 2100, we're still only going to see a very minuscule change in the temperature. So I think the question remains, is this really the best direction for the country, and is it worth the cost to the American public?
As we wrap up, do you think there is a good way to tackle reducing carbon emissions? What would you like to see instead of this clean power plan?
Well, I think just having the debate and having the conversation, if the American public believes that this is a change that they want, they will ask their elected representatives to do this. And as I mentioned earlier, back in 2010, the president couldn't convince members of his own party that this was the right thing to do in Congress. So I would much rather see us continue to have this debate, have the president talk directly to the American people and try and convince them that this is the right decision for the country.
Brett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brett Healy. He's president of the MacGyver Institute. He wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying, stand up to the Obama carbon rule. Climate talks will continue in Paris through next week.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We gotta find a paw print. That's the first clue. We put it in a notebook, and now what do we do? Blues, 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 blues.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest brought a new message to the table when he helped develop the popular children's TV series Blue's Clues in 1996. That message, he says, is as true today as it ever was. Don't underestimate the attention span of today's children.
He says children need diverse, complex content in TV shows and books to grow, and that's not what kids are often getting these days. So are we underestimating our kids and what they're able to understand? And if so, how do we get those more complex options in front of them?
In addition to being the co-creator of Blue's Clues, Todd Kessler is the author of the new children's book, The Good Dog. He also wrote an opinion piece for USA Today on kids, content, and attention spans. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
So big picture, Todd, are we as a society underestimating the entertainment needs and wants of our kids?
Well, there's a rumor going on in the public media that kids today have short attention spans. There's a lot of hand-wringing and worrying about all the devices, the phones, the screens, the pads, the computers that children are spending time with, and it's bandied about. You see it everywhere that children have short attention spans, but nobody's actually defined what an attention span is, let alone how you would actually test that. And my feeling is it's really easy to say kids aren't paying attention, but it's harder for ourselves as adults and especially as content creators to say, well, maybe they're not engaging as much because we're not providing them with good enough material.
So where does this idea of the short attention span come from, and why is it so persistent that it's been hanging on all these years?
That's a really good question. I wish I could answer it. I wasn't responsible for it, so I don't know where it came from. When I did do Blue's Clues, there was that same myth in the television industry. Sesame Street had promoted a magazine format of short segments no longer than 3 minutes apiece, and everybody thought then that kids couldn't possibly sit still for more than pay attention to one idea for more than 3 minutes. And I thought, well, no, if you tell them a good story, I knew from my experience with my own kids that, you know, they'll sit for an unbelievably long time if the story is good enough. So I proposed amid lots of skepticism, a show that was a continuous 24-minute narrative, which was Blue's Clues. And they didn't think it would succeed, but when we tested it with children, their attention was extremely high, and higher than Sesame Street.
How did you, you actually sat down kids and watched them and tried to measure their attention? How did you prove to these skeptical executives that, hey, this thing could actually work?
Well, luckily, in television, for preschoolers, there's actually a scientific method. So we hired an outside company, and what they do is they put a group of preschoolers in a room with a television, and they surround the kids with toys and books and other objects that would distract them, that are fun to play with. And then they go behind a two-way mirror. And behind that two-way mirror, there's one researcher for each preschooler. And they put the program on the TV. And then the simple scientific method is each researcher notes when the preschooler's eyes are on screen or they are distracted and playing with the items around them. And they track that throughout the program. The great thing about the preschool audience is they're honest. So if your show isn't good, they won't pretend to like it. They'll just turn away and start doing other stuff. So with that method of testing, Sesame Street at the time tested in the mid-70s around 73-74% attention. That means 73 or 74% of the time kids were watching and not doing other things. And Blue's Clues, we tested with our pilot 93% attention. So we knew we had something.
And Blue's Clues was, what, half an hour long?
Yes, half an hour. There actually was 25 minutes, but yes.
So do we know what the outer limits of the attention span might be? Are you gonna? Do you think that kids might have attention spans similar to adults, that they might sit down to watch and attend to a two-hour movie narrative?
Well, certainly they've been watching Walt Disney movies for generations, and those are 2 hours, and they certainly, you know, some of them are great and really hold kids' attention. Also, I mean, something you have to realize, too, is that kids do multitask, and it's, you know, they may be even getting more than you think out of it. But I think it's up to us to tell good stories with complex situations and rich characters that resemble the complexities of the people in the world that surrounds them, and that's what engages kids.
Talking to Todd Kessler, co-creator of the TV show Blue's Clues and author of the new children's book The Good Dog, he's making the case that as part of a kid's media and entertainment mix, they need longer form stuff, things with longer stories, 20-plus minutes shows on TV, and then, Todd, the books. And you say, you write that there's been a trend, shorter and shorter books, lower and lower word counts for preschool kids.
Yeah, I mean, if you go into a bookstore now, you'll find that 90-95% of the books available, or the books that have been published in the past 10 years, are in what they call the 32-page format. A few are in the 40-page format. And that's basically 24 pages of content, and they're usually limited to 500 to 700 words. We did a study. We randomly picked a dozen or so of the recently published books, and the average word count was actually under 500. Now, a 500 word book, or even a 700 word book, takes about 3.5 minutes to read. It's not much of an experience, a long experience for a kid. And to my mind, I think some of the short books are wonderful and the illustrations are brilliant, but to me, 500 to 700 words is more the amount of text you need to relate a poem, and they're poetry and they're nice moments and they might have a little lesson in them, but they're not a story with a narrative arc.
And it wasn't always like this either. That's kind of the interesting thing. As a parent, you really notice it. I have newer books, and then I have some older Dr. Seuss books left over from when I was a kid. And those books, you go, wow, these books are still going. You know, these are really chunky books.
Right.
And you're saying maybe it needs to be a little more like that, at least have those options on the table kids.
I think that there's room for all kinds of formats for kids, but what the format that has been neglected is the longer form book. You're right about Dr. Seuss, the Lorax, the Horton books, Horton Hears a Who. They're all about 2,000 words, which is the length of my book, The Good Dog. And children definitely have the capacity to sit still. We have reviews online of our book from parents saying, I read it to my 2.5-year-old kid, and they sat through the entire thing.
You said you want to see a mix. You don't want to get rid of the Sesame Street or the shorter books, but you want those longer ones. And I want to ask, what do we lose if we don't have those longer form options, those longer stories on TV in books?
I mean, I think you're missing an opportunity for kids to really sharpen their thinking skills, their thinking skills, their reasoning skills, their ability to make their own decisions. And I think it's really important, especially in today's world, to not baby our kids, but to give them material that's challenging and helps them become independent thinkers.
We're talking right now with author and Blue's Clues co-creator Todd Kessler. His new book is called The Good Dog. He's taking TV producers and publishers to task a little bit for reinforcing what he says is the myth of the short attention span. He says kids should have more complex and longer form TV and book content to help their minds grow.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're not giving kids enough credit when it comes to how much information they can process, how long they'll stick around and pay attention? Do you agree with our guests that we need more diverse and complex TV and book options for kids to grow? Is there a longer book, a TV show maybe, that you turn to that you think gets at this need? And what is it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with the author and Blue's Clues co-creator Todd Kessler. His new children's book is called The Good Dog, and he's here with us today to make the case that kids need more complex books and TV shows.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that entertainment options for kids are too dumbed down, or there aren't long-form ones? Do you think we underestimate the attention span of kids? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Joan is with us now in Spring Green. Joan, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think that we try to dummy it down too much. I don't have children of my own, but I have my nieces and nephews a lot, and it seems that when they're at my house, they will sit and listen to me read Where the Sidewalk Ends, Shel Silverstein. They'll sit for almost the entire book. These are 4- and 5-year-olds, and there's a 10-year-old. But for them, that opened up a whole new world for them. They want new experiences, and they want their minds to be tested and to be thinking about why they're reading and listening.
Joan, thanks a lot for that call. And so you're not the only one seeing this, Todd, definitely. Do you have any other favorites in books or TV world that you think will help solve the problem you're looking at?
There is very little. I think that part of the problem is economics, that the traditional book publishers figured, well, the 32-page format, it's really printed on one sheet of paper in China and cut up, and it's very inexpensive, and they make good money on it, so they've just decided to keep it simple. But no, there's really very little out there besides the older books, and we especially look to Dr. Seuss for inspiration, because many of his books were in a much longer format.
Thank you so much for that call. We're going to go next to Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're coming through.
Hi. I went to the Minnesota meeting of the Children's Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators about a month ago, and they were talking about a 500-word limit for children now. I'm going to say that's, I don't remember the age group that that was in, but, you know, I'm doing some writing for children, and I know I'm way too wordy. So I just wondered if your guests had talked about the word limits for different ages or not.
All right, great question. 500-word limit among some age groups. So what do you think about that?
That's Tom? Exactly what I'm talking about. It is, there is this unwritten rule among publishers and book agents that if you're going to submit a children's book, it had better be under between 500 and 700 words, or you should forget about it. And I think that this is really short-selling our children. Again, some books, the right story, you know, may fit into that format, but it excludes a whole genre of books with really rich narrative storytelling that children love and desire. I mean, we heard it from the couple phone calls that came in already.
This is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It could be,
yeah.
Oh, children's attention spans are short, so we're only going to give them short stuff, and that might make them have short attention spans in turn.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You got it.
And what do you think will change that assumption? I mean, Blue's Clues was out there. That was longer, and it was a hit TV show. What needs to happen to turn the corner?
It's always a fight. You know, after I did Blue's Clues, Nickelodeon came out with Dora, which was also a longer narrative format. We just have to lead by example. It's been, I'm excited about our book. I know the one thing I know is when it's in bookstores and independent bookstores and Barnes & Noble, everybody has really embraced it because it is completely different than anything else on the shelf. You can just see by how wide the spine is and how much it weighs. When you feel it in your hands, you know you're dealing with a different kind of book.
And you went into the book, The Good Dog, with a mission. I mean, you were trying to write a book to answer this problem you see out there, it sounds like.
Actually, I sat down and there was a story that I wanted to tell for children, and I wrote it. And I looked at it, and it seemed to be good. And then I did what I always do with these projects, is I put it in front of children. I read it to children. I had my teacher friends take it, to classes of kids, and they read it. And I saw that it worked. And when I knew that it worked for children, which is exactly what I did with Blue's Clues, then I decided to go ahead with it. And that's when I discovered that there were these rules about how long books could be. And I knew it would be a struggle and a challenge, and it was, but that was the fun of it. That was the fun of doing Blue's Clues, too.
We're talking with Todd Kessler right now, the co-creator of the TV show Blue's Clues, author of the new children's book, The Good Dog, talking about kids' attention spans. Our guest says they're a lot longer than we give kids credit for, and they need that to grow up and to learn and to be better readers, better thinkers. We're going to go next to our callers again. Tim is on the line with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hello. My son was raised originally on Blue's Clues. When he was 3, it was his favorite TV show. By the time he was 5, his favorite TV show was How It's Made, which is not specifically a TV show geared towards children. And he was also at that point reading Laura Ingalls Wilder books. And we, living in Wisconsin, brought him over to Caddy Woodlawn and all of that kind of stuff and showed him all of that. Now he is 8. And he's doing 6th grade curriculum and absolutely devouring it.
Tim, thanks a lot for that. And Todd, does that make sense to you? Do you think there is a correlation between these longer form things and achievement?
Oh, yeah, I identify with that. His statement there. When my daughter was 5 years old and we were living actually in New York City, I read her the entire Little House on the Prairie series. And I remember the most striking thing about it. So every night we would read as much as we could before we went to bed. And it took, I guess, about a year or so to read the whole series. And then the day we finished, when she was 6.5, 7 years old, she picked up the first book and began to read it again. And then she spent the next year reading the entire series again herself. So I really believe in the power of narrative storytelling. Laura, Little House on the Prairie is a fabulous example of that.
Todd, briefly, as we wrap up, are you a lone voice in the wilderness, or do you see other people taking up this message for longer content for kids?
If you run into them, let me know and have them give me a call, because we have not run into anyone yet doing what I'm doing with this book. I'm coming out with a second book in the spring as well, which is called The Good Dog and the Bad Cat, but which will also be the same length. But no, we have not seen anything, amazingly.
Todd, thanks a lot for spending time with us today.
It was great to be with you guys.
I've been talking to Todd Kessler. He's the co-creator of the children's TV show Blue's Clues. He's the author of the new children's book called The Good Dog.
The way we get our groceries has changed in the digital age. At a recent forum, the Wisconsin Innovation Network recently tried to gauge how much and if the changes will stick. Shemaine Mills reports.
Many of us have booked airline tickets online or reserved hotels using the internet. But some industries and their customers have been slower to use technology. Brendan Scholes is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Grocers Association.
Our industry is just extraordinarily traditional. I mean, it is about as traditional as you can get.
Most people still go to the store, pick out what they want, and have it scanned in the checkout line. Fresh Madison Market is busy on this weekday as store director Christy Maurer bags at customers' groceries. Nowadays, going to the store with a fistful of coupons isn't the only option. As more people get broadband, fewer have cars, and customers seek convenient food, both buyer and seller are seeing a role for technology. Fetch, for instance. It's a smartphone app that keeps a running tally of shoppers' purchases and offers manufacturer coupons. Tim Philosophus is an angel investor in Fetch Rewards.
So you don't have to clip coupons. It's just automatically done. And then might present opportunities. If, say, you're buying sausages, you're buying brats, might tell you that, you know, buns are on sale.
Stores are also offering online shopping and delivery. Fresh Madison Market's Tim Perboski has downloaded a customer's order and is putting items in a cart before it will be delivered.
Move on and grab some eggs.
People are still buying eggs even though the price went up.
Yep, they're getting expensive, but still a pretty good seller. More snacks now. I want some Gushers.
Online shopping and delivery is not new. Peapod's been doing it since 1989. Philosopher says the company survived while others, like Webvan, went bankrupt.
It's interesting, the largest dot-com bust of all time was actually a grocery delivery company. Now, in terms of the internet, it was like three lifetimes ago. Okay, it was 1999.
With that cautionary tale in mind, grocers may be hesitant to invest in online shopping. The industry has what Brendan Scholes says are razor-thin margins. But at the same time, grocers know customer service is a way to compete beyond price and quality. And online shopping may be what keeps customers coming back.
While there are great opportunities out there, customers are still very traditional. We talk a lot about millennials and what that brings to the store and how you cater to millennials. But there are still a lot of old baby boomers out there like me who aren't on Facebook.
Scholes says the grocery industry has seen a lot of changes over the years in how and when people shop.
It used to be that Wednesdays and Sundays were the big shopping days. Seniors, double coupon days, and Sundays after church. Well, that's changed.
And as customer habits change, stores adapt. Fetch Reward investor Philosophus points to a Nielsen study showing customers may be willing to buy groceries online, but whether they actually do is another matter. Many still go to the store.
61% of these global respondents enjoy the grocery shopping experience. So it's not going away.
Traditional shoppers may be the majority, but Fresh Madison Market store director Christy Maurer says they've had online shopping since they opened in 2010.
Everyone else in the Madison area is offering it, so to be a business and be competitive as well, you have to offer that service.
So even though most customers don't use these services now, businesses have to invest in the future for fear that they'll be left behind. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about how the decision to allow women in all combat roles will affect our armed forces. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can follow us online and on social media. Go to WPR.org, check out the Central Time Facebook page, and you can always tweet us with responses to our programming and show ideas at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.